is One Dish, One Mic, a podcast, now a broadcast, with Carl Dockstader and Sean Vanderkliss on News Talk 610 CKTB.
Good morning, Niagara. It is Sunday, January 17th, and we are live for One Dish, One Mic. We have quite the show lined up for you today. The one and only, the incredible, as Mr. Carl Dockstader says, Helen Knott will be on the show. For those of you who don't know, Helen Knott is an award-winning author and poet and is the author of the book In My Moccasins, In My Own Moccasins. My apologies, I'm screwing up already. Glad I'm getting it out of the way now and not later on. But yeah, it is a new Sunday. The sun is shining, and we are here to talk about issues affecting Indigenous people. And more specifically, I guess we're talking about our fellowship has started.
Yeah, we're 1 week into the world of journalism, but Sean and I are now hardened, seasoned journalists. They put us through the rites of passage.
That's right. We did all the rites of passage. I had to do this weird thing with a mop and bucket.
Right. I got a lot of coffees for people. I guess this is all crucial to understanding journalism.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so happy we're not in Winnipeg.
Right.
Like, go clean the toilet, Sean. I'm like, no.
The first half of the morning, here's how you work the cappuccino machine. Make sure my milk is extra frothy.
But we're a week in, and I think we are both close to having our first bylines. Is that correct, Carl?
Yeah, I'm on the verge of getting my first byline. But I have to admit, like, we do a lot of editorial framing of our stories here. I think it's crucial for Indigenous issues, actually, for us to have an editorial perspective, because I think it creates balance to mainstream media, which has had the so-called view from nowhere.
Yeah.
Which is just a fancy way of saying the view of, like, old rich white guys.
Yeah.
So we counter that with our editorial perspective. There's like none of that at the CBC.
Yeah. And I mean, that is CBC historically is that news agency that has its journalistic standards and principles that often have to be adhered to. And here at One Dish, One Mic, well, we have Steve Martin.
Is Steve Martin our journalistic standards and practices?
That's too much for me, even. I don't know that I want to take on that burden. I know we chat after the show every once in a while, but I'm not journalistic standards.
We usually go and write down everything you say and do exactly that, just so you know you have
Uh-oh.
That power.
Uh-oh.
That's why we bring you the coffee in the morning.
Well, I appreciate the coffee and the chat. I shouldn't say I don't appreciate the chat, but the coffee.
It's thank you. That's our fearless leader, Steve Martin. So it's definitely been a reframing of perspective. It's amazing though to see, like, the average age of the not that, you know, age affects work or anything like that.
Oh, it does.
But nope. The average age of the newsroom is they're younger people. Like, they're closer to your age than my age.
The age affects perception, and it affects point of view, and it's refreshing, and it's just refreshing to work with people who are closer to my age. And yeah, this is no slight against you, Carl Dockstader.
No, it's all good. I don't take it that way at all. But I mean, of all of the newsrooms in Canada, I just think it's neat that every single day this group of young Indigenous journalists from different communities, like Chantal Bell-Richard out on the West Coast,
yeah,
and then Nick Maloney, who's working closest with us out on the East Coast, and like Ganesi O'Dear, Leonard Monkman in Manitoba.
Yeah.
Like, they're just journalists everywhere. Rhiannon Johnson,
yeah,
up in your home community.
Right? That's right. She's out of Peterborough. She's from Hiawatha and has connections to Curve Lake First Nation. So shout out to Rhiannon Johnson.
I think she might actually be your cousin. There may have been half of an entire meeting dedicated to your family.
We may have did the whole are we related bit on one of our pitch meetings.
Yeah.
The answer is I don't know. To be determined.
The questions that I'm asking myself for this will be the last week that we'll be in with the CBC Indigenous staff themselves, and then we'll be moving over to shadow under the unreserved staff. So,
yeah.
So I guess the questions I'm asking myself are, how much of an opportunity is there to talk about systems journalism? Like, we have themes, right? We're always talking about leadership.
Yeah.
We're always talking about identity. We're trying to unpack more complex constructs like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We're talking about land back, like unapologetically talking about land ran back, and it's different when you're trying to catch that so-called news hook.
Yeah, and that said, there has to be some sort of hook, which I don't want to say that this is a representation of CBC. I think this is just a representation of news organizations and news in general. There has to be some sort of selling point for it to be news. And I think that's one of the downfalls in news, is that if without that selling point, stories don't get told, right? So if we look at that same standard and apply it to 1492 Land Back Lane, stories aren't getting sold until there's tires on the road, yeah, right? And what they're missing is that opportunity. What I think news agencies are missing is that opportunity to tell a grander story of why 1492 Land Back Lane is there, right? The history of 1492 Land Back Lane.
And that's what we're seeing with many of the CBC Indigenous journalists, is they're actually very knowledgeable in their subject matter expertise, not just being Indigenous, not just having Indigenous, yeah, perspectives, but again, like having someone like Anasi Odir that's right in Ganawage, that's plugged into the Confederacy and the perspective of Mohawks relative to the Confederacy and the back and forth of the band council and the traditional councils and the different things that happen. And then having Nick Maloney, who I mean, we had a very interesting conversation about Eastern Métis, and the positioning of Métis broadly, and then the positioning of Mi'kmaq communities, and again, so you have these journalists that have this like wealth of knowledge, but that doesn't always come across in each individual story, because again, they're chasing the thing that's sort of, you know, this thing that happened right now.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's one of the limits of journalism, like that. You know, I'm not obviously going to the meeting saying that, but
yeah. I don't know if that's the case, because like for the story that I'm working on, I was under the impression that like, hey, we need this today, right? We have a 5 p.m. deadline. You have to get this in at 5 p.m., right? So I'm busting my butt off trying to get some stuff done, and then it turns out that no, we can just push it back a little bit.
Yeah.
So I don't know that there is that pressure to get things out in an expedient fashion, which is good, because like again, as a journalist for the Niagara Falls Review, like we're dailies. We're called the Niagara Dailies for a reason, meaning that every single day I'm pushing out a story.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's the case for CBC. I could be wrong, though. Maybe it's just, again, I'm new, so it's the first story that I've ever worked on with CBC. So I could be mistaken. But yeah, I don't know that I would agree.
I mean, we've been told that CBC Indigenous is not a breaking news,
yeah,
outlet. That's not what they're looking for. So I think they are looking for a little bit of underlying and system stuff,
yeah,
that's going on. So I don't know. I'll be curious to unpack it a little bit. We definitely have gotten a lot of freedom that I'm pretty pleased about, and lots of direction, and it's neat to learn. And I hope that this can improve the way that One Dish, One Mic tells stories on the radio with the things that we're learning.
100%. One of the things that I like is that the story I'm working on, there is not a lot of background information out there that is readily available. And I really think that we've hit like an untapped market for this story specifically. So a significant part of my story that I'm telling includes that context that has been historically missing, like since for the last 100 years. Anytime this community is ever brought up, they have a complicated past, and this past has never been told. And I'm happy that I get to be one of the people who tells that past. And I think that's going to be beneficial to us as at One Dish, One Mic, is learning the systems in place that make up for good storytelling, good journalism, and it's quite the ride so far.
Yeah, and I think that there's room to add to the collective at not just that newsroom, but all newsrooms in general. And that's an element of this particular fellowship and of many of the fellowships that are out there right now, is that newsrooms need to be more equitable and need to have that range of voices. And if there's one thing, again, that you and I talk about all the time on One Dish, One Mic, is that there's not this like monolithic, singular Indigenous First Nations voice. They're a broad range of voices. And that's what's really neat, again, is to watch these sort of newsroom story pitch ideas and to see all these different perspectives. And then when we throw our stories into the mix, there's still plenty of room for that.
Yeah.
Even in an Indigenous specific newsroom.
Yeah, exactly. The only criticism I would ever give CBC, and I'll happily give on air, is the fact that I think there needs to be more reporters at CBC Indigenous. I think we were quoted at seven staff covering the whole country. To me, that's a little small. I would imagine at least one per province and territory in my head makes sense. But yeah, that's the only criticism I would ever give. But on the flip side, that's why the stories that we pitch have some value and have some credit to it, is because we're offering a different perspective. But yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think there's room to grow in that. So we're over here on Bell Media, on the Bell Media side of things as well. And so I've been watching obviously things that happen on CTV, things that happen across the iHeartRadio network and the other Bell Media news networks. And I think there are efforts in our own company, the way that the company stood behind me with when I had my charges with 1492 Lamback Lane. Like, that was unequivocal, and Bell was very quick to put resources and support behind me, which I'm very grateful for. So there are things that are happening, and again, that's the thing that I'm looking at. Is it's not just one newsroom, but this particular newsroom, it reminds me of how volunteering on a board of directors for the Native Center shifted paradigms for me. Like, I'd worked primarily for non-Indigenous organizations, and then I got on the NRNC board, and then it shifted perspectives in that, my goodness, Indigenous people can have their own thing, their own organizations, their own, like, operate things in their own way. And now seeing that reflected in a newsroom, I think is pretty cool.
It is. It's good to be in a room of like-minded individuals, people with the same perspectives, people not necessarily the same perspectives, but a similar perspective, and people with I mean, people that you see as your peers, right? It's refreshing, right? Like, I like you said, it's reminiscent of going to that Friendship Center and seeing people who look like you.
Yeah.
And it's very refreshing going into a newsroom and seeing people who look like you. And I guess that's our first week at CBC.
Yeah. So we could I don't know if you want to tease your story a little bit or not, after we take a short moment.
Yeah.
We do have a couple things we're working on, but mostly I'm excited because we have Helen Knott, who's going to come and join us after the 11 a.m. hour. So if you have questions for her, if you have things you want us to talk to her about, again, it's a great author. We did ask everyone to read all of In My Own Moccasins before the show today. So if you've read it and you want to share your notes with us, then we'll definitely include that in the segment. So text us at 61010 with your thoughts. We have more late, great, breaking, exciting radio coming for you in a short moment.
More with Sean and Carl on One Dish, One Mic. From News Talk 610, CKTV.
You're listening to One Dish, One Mic at the House of Talk. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening, if you're here to listen to us talk, that is exactly what you are going to get. We're not going to talk.
We're going to try and talk. Anyway.
Yeah, not too well.
We're going to make an effort to talk. We're going to make some words live on the air. There was a great segment with Steve Christie before us, which I sat in the cold parking lot listening to for the entire duration of the interview because it was riveting, but also because the Bills had a gigantic victory. Yeah. And I realize that's not Indigenous specific, but I just don't care because I'm in a great mood because the Bills are happy.
So, crazy enough, I've never really listened to Rod Mahood's station or show that much. I'm just not a big football guy, right? But I was listening today because I was in the car from like 9:30 on, and it was fantastic. Like, the people that he has on, like, mind-boggling. I'm like, how do you know these people, Rod?
Rod's show, like, I aim for what Rod does on his show for our show. So Rod's show is a sports-themed show, but it also happens to be great radio.
Yeah.
He is an exceptional interviewer.
Yeah.
And the first time, this is going back a couple of years, but he spoke with a police officer who was a former athlete who had PTSD, and, like, it was a powerful. Like, it was another one where I think, you know, I kind of listen to the radio while I'm, like, puttering around the house and doing things and whatever, and it was one where I, like, stopped. Like, I stopped what I was doing, like, dish towel in hand, standing over the kitchen sink, not wanting to miss a minute of this very riveting radio. So yeah, Rod's a great interviewer. He's an asset to Niagara, and we're very fortunate to be on after him.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, like, I've always known that he was a good radio host and really good at engaging with the audience and the people that he had on, but just the connections itself were just, again, mind-boggling. Like, good for CT, good for Bell for having Rod on. Like, shout out to them. Also, shout out to Rod for being fantastic.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I think it's part of the station's commitment to, to local radio, too. Like, Rod was the beginning of pioneering this sort of, like, we benefited from it, right?
Yeah.
We were brought on as local Indigenous voices and sort of two guys that were just on the street doing whatever. but because of the station's commitment to have local voices on. But if it wasn't for Rod, I'm not sure that it gets to that. Because I think Rod was the first in what's now sort of a network with Ruth's show and with a lot of the stuff that's happening with, like, Chrissy's show, Parental Guidance, like a lot of the Saturday lineup, and now the lineup that we have today is all a product of the fact that Rod did so well with the show. So, yeah. But I just wanted to say that I am in a phenomenal mood today because the Buffalo Bills just, like, smoked the Baltimore Ravens, and yeah, it's
17-3.
Yes, nothing can bring me down. It's very exciting.
I was kind of hoping for.
You heard the song a lot last night.
I was hoping that the Ravens caught that touchdown pass with around the 3-minute mark to make it a little more interesting. Like, I would have been comfortable with a 17-10, a little more dramatic ending to a game. That being said, I'm not the biggest football fan out there, so maybe that's not an appropriate thing to say, but I'm happy for you, Carl, that your team has moved on and they're going for the AFC, presumably against Kansas City.
Yeah, we'll find out today whether they play Kansas City or the Browns.
Not to overlook the Cleveland or anything, but Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah, right? The greatest quarterback of our time, not named Josh Allen.
Yeah.
He will be playing this afternoon.
Josh, yeah. I love you.
Right? So, yeah, this is probably not what people tuned in for, but I just wanted to have that very self-indulgent moment.
This is Niagara relevant, so it's okay.
I wonder if they win enough, if they'll lift the curse. Maybe someday we'll have to talk about the curse on the air. I would actually like to explore that as a story. Maybe that's an idea for a CBC Indigenous story, actually, is the origin of the rumor of the curse that was put on the Buffalo Bills by Haudenosaunee people as a result of where the stadium's located. So,
no, it's not coming. It's not being lifted.
Yeah. The curse isn't going to be lifted.
No, I speak for all 100.
If the Raptors
people.
Can win an NBA championship, then anything can happen.
What the?
If they let a Canadian team.
Excuse me? What did you just say? Okay, let's talk about something.
Right?
Does your group have to follow the COVID lockdown rules? My group? My children most definitely do. Listen, my kids tried to go outside the other day. I'm like, no! what do you want to talk about? Vaccines.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about vaccines?
What's your story that you're doing tomorrow?
Oh, my story. I forgot we have a show layout. So, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who aren't interested, or those of you who aren't too informed on what's happening near Curve Lake First Nations, more specifically around Peterborough, and more specifically around Burley Falls, is that a blockade has gone up. A group of... I think it's fair to say a First Nations community by the name of Kawartha Anishinaabe have put up a blockade to protest a dam reconstruction that is set to happen at Lock 28 in and around Peterborough, in and around Burley Hills or Burley Falls area. And the part of the problem is that this community, this Kawartha Anishinaabe, are alleging that they weren't consulted in this. And Parks Canada blatantly said, hey guys, we didn't even know you existed. Wow. And they went on the record and said this. They said this to one of the local reporters, Angela LaValle. Shout out to Angela LaValle. She is from Curve Lake as well. So it's good to see that Indigenous people from Curve Lake are participating in journalism. But they went on the record of saying, well, why didn't they know that this was happening? And what ended up happening is, as I was doing a Google search, is that there is not too much information about the Kawartha Anishinaabe Bay there. And the reason that there isn't is because of this community, this set of families back in the 1910s were essentially enfranchised. So part of the government's policy back in the day was to make Indigenous people Canadians, was to strip them of their identity and to give them rights of an average Canadian. When you hear the term enfranchise, usually that has a positive connotation, right? The term enfranchisement means that you're giving rights to somebody. You're giving them the right to vote.
vote as an example. And for women, that would be a fantastic thing, right? Women were enfranchised in the 1920s in Canada. The right to vote was a good thing. But for Indigenous people, it was quite the opposite. Indigenous people, in order to become Canadians, they had their rights stripped away via the Indian Act, right? And our treaty rights that were guaranteed. So these families who oftentimes fought in the wars, as an example, some of them fought in World War I. When they came back, they were automatically enfranchised, meaning they gave up all of their rights. And because of, in order to live on reserves at that time, you needed to be a status Indian as defined under the Indian Act. So what they ended up doing is they ended up creating their own community in and around Burleigh Falls, and they built a community on an island, and that island then became the future site of the dam that they're considering redoing, or not considering, that they've made the decision to demolish and rebuild. And that's the story, is that this community who has been fighting for identity, has been fighting for the rights to exist, is now fighting for the rights to be included in any decision making conversations that are happening around the area. And it's interesting too, because like, I'm from Curve Lake, and we signed a treaty. Multiple nations within that area signed a treaty. It's called the 1923 Williams Treaty that says who is a title holder to that land. And Curve Lake is a title holder to that land that was set out by the government and in conjunction with all of our nations. And because they were non-status at that time, they weren't afforded the opportunity to sign that treaty. So it's brought up a lot of interesting dynamics that we should be talking about here on One Dish, One Mic, is the concept of identity, right? So I just went on like a 5-minute rant.
No, it's a good story. It's the intersection of a lot of issues that we talk about. Who ultimately decides who is and isn't Indigenous is a huge question that we ask on this show. Yeah. So I am super excited to see this story when it's published, because I think it's going to unpack a little bit of answering that with a specific example too. Like, you and I have talked about our own experiences.
Yeah.
We've had texters text in about their own perspectives on who is and isn't Indigenous, but then also who gets to decide that. So it's a huge question. We have an ongoing dialogue with a friend of the show about Russ Dibo, who has been very critical of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And then you have somebody like Romeo Saganash, whose life's work it was really to get this into legislation.
Yeah.
And those views are conflicting. So is it a colonial threat from a mainstream Canadian government that's seeking to assimilate us and to extinguish our rights, which is sort of what Russ Dibo is saying, is that it's a tool to accomplish that? Or is it what Romeo Saganash says, in that it's a tool in our toolkit that's going to give us more options in the ways that we liberate ourselves? But taking it back to the example that you were giving, I think teasing this conversation out, and I believe that you actually spoke to I've now learned this, it's a two perspective story that you'll be telling.
Yeah, exactly. So we're getting the perspective of Curve Lake as well as the OPP. And who else? We reached out to Parks Canada. So I'm covering the story with Rhiannon Johnson. It makes sense because both of us have ties to Curve Lake. So she's taken that perspective, and I've taken this perspective of the Kawartha and Anishinaabe, which, I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, and the other thing to consider too is that there is a lot of hurt feelings in this area, right? Kawartha, from my perspective. A lot of the Curve Lakers see these people as non-Indigenous and see these people as people who just left the community willfully. And I don't think that that's the case. I think that's an unfair statement to put on the people of Burleigh Falls. So it's interesting. It's really interesting. I can't wait for the story to be published. Expecting Monday, expecting Tuesday, but it's good to work on. I think I'm going to try to do another follow-up story on it as well.
Yeah, there's lots. So, and the other thing that we've learned at CBC Indigenous is that pitch pitch the journalists you know. So, and we do operate One Dish, One Mic like this all the time. Like, we've had great story ideas that have come from listeners and from texters and from people that contact us through social media. So if you have ideas for stories, then you can reach out to us. We have another avenue with which to tell that story. If you have Comment Today show, you can text us at 61010. We're going to listen to the people that make One Dish, One Mic possible, and then we'll be right back to tell more stories of the week while we're waiting for Helen Knott, who joins us right after the 11 o'clock news. We'll be right back.
One Dish, One Mic with Carl and Sean on 610 CKTB.
We're live and we're learning how to do journalism live on air, behind the scenes. Maybe not live on air, but behind the scenes.
That was a fast intro. I thought you were going to like auction something. We're live, we're on the air, you're listening to One Dish, One Mic, you text us at 610 with your ideas and your questions.
My son told me yesterday I sounded like a hillbilly, and I don't know if that's offensive. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on air, but he said, Dad, you sound like a hillbilly. And I said, well, you're grounded.
If you know a hillbilly, text 610. No, we better not. We better not. We do have some texters. Our friend of the show, Elaine from Welland, said, great story to work on, Sean, and franchisemen and those who chose not to be defined under the Indian Act. Right on. Yep. Right on. And then Elaine also said this began in Canada in the 1850s and became legislation in 1857 with the Gradual Civilization Act. Sneaky buggers.
They are. So fun fact about enfranchisement.
Is it really a fun fact about enfranchisement?
Yes, this is a fun fact. This is a fun fact about enfranchisement.
All right.
Is that the government, when it came out with enfranchisement, they came out for the first policy they came out with was called volunteer enfranchisement, which essentially meant that they thought that Indigenous people would be lined up out the door to switch their status in Canada, to give up Indian status, to become Canadians. And this policy was in effect for around 15 years. And what ended up happening is only one person made the decision to give up their status. One person. And that's where the mandatory enfranchisement came into play. So if you went to university, you were enfranchised. If you left the reserve, you're enfranchised. If you joined the military, you're enfranchised. If you hired a lawyer, you're enfranchised, so on and so forth. So the fun story is, or the fun fact is, that they thought we would want to do this and we would willingly do this. Boy, were they wrong. So that's my fun fact about enfranchisement.
Still to this day, I think there's this notion that being Canadian is the... Man, I don't want to tick off Canadians when you talk about how maybe being Canadian isn't the greatest thing that ever happened.
Yeah.
I've seen people be, like, visibly offended.
Yeah.
Or when I've said, like, hey, I'm not Canadian, and they're like, well, don't you want to be Canadian? And it's like, as a matter of fact, I don't want to be Canadian.
Yeah.
Your people have been trying to do this for several generations.
Yeah.
Our people have rejected this, and as a matter of fact, no, it's you know, do your thing. You know, whatever, yeah. Your John A. statues or whatever, being in maple syrup, you know, all that stuff, even though that's like a Haudenosaunee Anishinaabe thing. But still, you do your Canadian things, and I'm going to do my not Canadian things. So I don't know how much has changed between 1857 and the Gradual Civilization Act and now, right?
No, not much. I still have debates with my friends about Canada being the standard bearer of what is right or what should be right. But yeah, I mean, it's the world you grow up in, I guess. It's the perception that you have. Nationalism, as much as we associate that with America and things like that, nationalism exists here today in Canada, right? You, what does Ford say when he ends, God bless the Queen, God bless,
God bless Ontario?
God bless Ontario, something like that.
God bless the Trillium? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't, like, it still exists, right? It's people love the concept of Canada.
I'm not against the concept of Canada per se, but I would like those values like defined a little bit better.
Yeah.
Like Canada is a multicultural mosaic, I think, or a multicultural tapestry of different cultures was the sort of aim of Trudeau Senior's government. But I would like to see that fleshed out a little bit more when things like anti-immigration for the sake of anti-immigration sentiments just sort of settle in to become a mainstream value that like, you know, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of Canadians support, then I sort of ask myself, well, you're the ones whose leadership said that your country country is a multicultural tapestry. And now here you are with some pretty fiery anti-immigrant rhetoric. So yeah. How does that reflect in your values? How hardened are these values?
Well, I mean, it's like, don't even get me started on multiculturalism in Canada. It's like, well, I guess we're multicultural. I guess we'll have some immigrants come into this country. But yeah, it's a thing of convenience for Canada, and a lot of the government is we're multicultural, or we welcome immigration when it's convenient, when there is a political benefit to doing so. And that is, I mean, counter to their point or to their claim that we're a multicultural tapestry.
I just finished Unsettling Canada by Art Manuel this morning, and it talks about the treatment of Indigenous people, and Art Manuel is the father to Kahanas Manuel, and the son of a former national chief and political figure, so there's sort of three generations of political involvement. But it happens every single time I go through history. A lot of the things that are happening that happened in the 1850s and the turn of the 1900s and throughout the 1900s and into the 2000s and across the Harper government and even into the current government are the same sorts of themes, those same sticking points, that basically it would just be easier for Canada if we were all Canadians and if we would all just sort of buy into Canadian values. And every time they try to push it, whether it's the white paper or whether it's the Stephen Harper legislative agenda that sparked Idle No More, every time that happens, where Canada really tries to dig in and says, okay, guys, enough is enough with this treaty stuff or whatever, this sovereignty stuff. You're going to be Canadian. That's when they really upset the community and when the community lets it be known, whether it's the Constitution Express or whether it's the pushback against the white paper or whether it's the all the activism that followed OCA and the OCA resistance or Idle No More in the past 10 years or whatever is next, unless the government sort of changes their tune, is there's this fundamental disconnect. And until Canada at large can acknowledge the fact that we'd like being Indigenous and we want to continue to be Indigenous, then we're going to continue to have these stuck points.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to continue to raise our kids to fight for our sovereignty, fight for Indigenous identity, so on and so forth. So as long as Canada is raising their children to assimilate, we're going to be seeing the same story repeated time after time, decade after decade, right? It's like in my head, I see it happening around every 10 years. Within 7 to 10 years, there is some sort of national event that sparks huge controversy about Indigenous people inserting their traditional and inherent rights, and Canada kind of saying, well, no, that's not the case.
Well, it's tied to usually the government will only come so far. And so Art Manuel unpacks a lot of great history in his book. But he talks about the Delgamuu decision and how the Delgamuu decision led to a new era of treaty negotiation in BC, dealing with both the BC provincial government and the federal government. But in order to have a claims process, so if you wanted to claim a treaty right, the first thing you would have to do before entering into negotiation was acknowledge that you were willing to effectively waive or extinguish your existing treaty rights. So you'd have to, like, right off the hop, sign off on a piece of paper that said, okay, I no longer have a historical treaty right. I'm now going to enter into this, like, comprehensive claims process, and I'm going to agree to fall under this new regime, which is just a fancy way of eliminating Indigenous rights. And it still goes on to this day.
So that's beneficial, like, hypothetically speaking, that would be beneficial, let's say, BC, where historically there weren't too many treaties that were signed, right? BC is largely regarded as unceded territory. Do you think that's why it was put in? Versus, let's say, the further east you moved, where treaties are, I mean, ideally should be the law, that is not the case.
Well, yeah, like, so the
do you think there's
the
a
contrast...
short, do you think there's a short-sightedness there?
I don't know, because I guess the contrast, like, to sort of work with your example and not to always talk about our region, is that you have the Peace and Friendship Treaty that the Sipaganagadi and other Mi'kmaq nations gave them the legal right through the Marshall decision to fish.
Yeah.
And so you look at that, and honestly, it kind of looks like the way that right was rationed out as a moderate livelihood out on the East Coast is pretty similar to how the Nishka Treaty is the example that Art Manuel holds up as a sort of problematic treaty, because the Nishka people, in order to enter into, like, years and years and years of negotiations, had to start off with extinguishing that right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the argument that you would that some Department of Fisheries and Oceans officials and government officials would like to see out east is like, okay, first waive your traditional rights, and then you can participate in our fisheries under our framework and under an approved Department of Fisheries and Oceans mandate, as opposed to doing it the way that your nation wants to do it. So I still think that regardless of whether there's an existing treaty or not, that the government still wants to erase the historical right, mm-hmm. because it's a bad deal from an economic perspective. If you're just sort of business capitalist, these deals that anybody would share revenue in perpetuity, these kinds of deals are not signed in modern treaty negotiations, but these were required for Canada to form as a country. So I don't think so. Like, the really long, after saying many words, the short answer to your question is that no, whether there's a treaty, whether the land's ceded or unceded, I think either way, Canada's trying to wriggle itself off of a legal hook that's binding. And these treaties are binding. They're foundational to Canada. The courts have upheld it. The Constitution upholds it. There's no way around the fact that these Indigenous rights exist unless they can get Indigenous people to voluntarily enfranchise themselves, which they haven't done yet.
So to clarify, modern treaties, yay or nay?
I'm totally, again, just echoing what Art Manuel said.
Yeah.
I tend to think that there's some reason in Art Manuel's criticism of the modern treaty negotiating process.
Yeah.
Anytime you frame a treaty in the context of Canadian law only, I think that limits the nature of what a treaty is about. You can't have a treaty within a nation. Like, you and I can't have a treaty amongst each other, right?
Yeah.
Like, if we're separate nations, we can enter into a treaty, but then your legal framework is as important as my legal framework. And it's just something that in Canada, on a very technical level, it hasn't ever really happened, unless I'm mistaken. But I think that, again, just following what Art Manuel was trying to say in Unsettling Canada, I think that's by design, and a lot of it is for economic reasons, and mm-hmm. it's still ongoing.
Well, I'm excited to read that book. Fun fact, I have a lot of fun facts today. I bought that book for my girlfriend. It's one of her first Christmas gifts.
Oh, you bought it. You bought it for her.
Yeah, for
to
her,
read
to
and
her,
then to tell you
to
about
summarize
what was in it.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well.
Needless to say, she did not summarize that for me.
We are minutes away from having Helen Knott join us. This is a guest that we have been wanting to be on One Dish, One Mic for a long time.
Going back a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've been hoping that Helen Knott would join us. She has very graciously agreed to join us on our show shortly. We are going to take a short break. We have one more segment, and then Helen Knott will be on right after that. We'll be back in a second.
With Sean and Carl on One Dish, One Mic from News Talk 610 CKTV.
January 17th, Sean and Carl are riding high after a historical Buffalo Bills win, bringing them to the AFC Championship. That's right. That's the Indigenous issue that everybody wants to know about. So just in case your TV was broken, your Twitter was broken, all of your social media feeds were down, yes, the Buffalo Bills did victoriously triumph over the Baltimore Ravens, and I'm good. That's all the news I needed. Yeah. That's all the storytelling that I needed for the week was tonight.
Story is done.
Yep.
Steve, close the station.
Right. That's it. We're officially off the air forever.
I'm not a big Buffalo Bills fan. But I did purchase DAZN last night simply to watch the game. So Buffalo Bills, you have me right where you want me. I'm giving my money up just for you.
I have all the Bell Media products actually through my cable subscription, and it allows for really great streaming options, so you can support Bell Media and still listen. We have a texter that texted Sing.
Yeah, we have a
Sing.
Damn it, Gary Parker.
Right? It's not going to happen. Yeah. I sang, what, last week or the week before?
You did sing,
I was waiting for you to come up with an idea, yeah. So I
maybe,
just sang.
Maybe if you weren't slacking all the time, Gary.
Fill some time, right? Yeah. That's, yeah,
also, Gary, how were the hot dogs, by the way? I saw your social media last night. How were those salines?
How did he get his hands on American?
I don't know
if we should be outing people on the air like that.
Oh, why? Can't you buy them in Canada? No?
You can't buy a Salem's hot dog in Canada,
oh,
no.
Well, I didn't know
it's,
that.
It's like a Western New York okay. specific thing, man.
Well, Roman Hill, how was Lenovo's pizza, too?
Look at you. Look at you.
See you. I am most interested in Helen Knott's political activism. And, of course, if she has a take on UNDRUP and thoughts about any observed controversy within Indigenous communities around Romeo Saganosh's bill. And I think that's a fair criticism. The way I see it is we have two perceived heavyweights taking on two polar opposite sides of view of a legislation, Romeo Saganosh being the one who was the author of the bill that went through, that died on the Senate floor about the implementation around UNDRIP, right? So Romeo Saganosh took it upon himself, introduced new legislation, passed in the House of Commons, and then died on the Senate floor. Because that's where bills usually die. This House of Sober Second Thought, they call it. Whereas Russ Diabo ran for the Assembly of First Nations National Grand Chief. I believe that he worked for the AFN. He's really into policy. Has a counter argument, and Carl's going to explain that counter argument right now.
Yeah, so just a little more context. I think Romeo Saganosh had a very distinguished career as a member of Parliament, and really was a pioneer in a lot of ways in advocating for Indigenous people. And for a lot of times, we would actually lead into our show with his comment talking to Justin Trudeau about how he doesn't give a blank about Indigenous people. So Romeo Saganosh championed this legislation, which comes on the heels of the advocacy and activism of people like Art Manuel, with whom Russ Diabo was closely associated. Art Manuel thanks Russ Diabo for a lot of his pioneering work, especially in the 80s when they wrote liberal policy for the Liberals, who were the party of opposition for the majority of the 80s during the Mulroney government, got elected as an anti-NAFTA sort of vote, but then went on to support NAFTA anyways, like all of the Western governments. But then when they got in, they also, Chrétien was no friend to Indigenous people and took the hard work of Russ Diabo and a team of Indigenous thought leaders and discarded it and didn't really use it as part of the Liberal policy. Made a bunch of election promises, got a strong mandate that included recognizing Indigenous rights, and then had a long-term governing and didn't really do anything about Indigenous rights beyond lip service. Mm-hmm. I know that's shocking to hear that a Liberal government might do that. So Russ Diabo at that time changed his scope, started working for Indigenous people, wrote a lot of papers around self-determination and how our determination is connected to land and water resources and really being independent as people. He was one of the leading voices in Idle No More. And again, has shifted back and forth in and out of the AFN, usually playing that critic role, though. So most recently, though, Russ Diabo has taken a strong stance against the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And as we mentioned in the last segment, as I'll sort of reiterate again, I believe that the basis of his argument is that there should have been consultation with Indigenous communities before, there should have been more inclusion of Indigenous perspectives before, and what Romeo Saganosh, I believe, is saying, and a view that I tend to lean towards supporting, is that this will become a legislative tool that will empower Indigenous people. So when the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which people like Bob Antonga from Oneida and like a lot of really respected Indigenous scholars and leaders help negotiate the framework that force the United Nations to recognize that Indigenous rights are separate from the rights of other peoples. It also helped acknowledge the fact that Indigenous peoples are more than just a population group or a special interest group. The reason we call ourselves Indigenous peoples is it gives us a very legal, distinct status. So again, I think that acknowledging this particular piece of legislation is a tool in the toolkit that Indigenous people can use to achieve equity and to achieve status and to work towards our goals of self-determination and to advance our continued self-government.
I agree. I take the same perspective that any tool that we can use, any tool that we have in our toolbox to help assert our rights as Indigenous people is a tool that we should have. And to say that we need to be consulted before this legislation passes is, I think it's a slap in the face to all the people who were consulted during the implementation of UNDRIP with the United Nations itself. Because there was a lot of work that went on for that Now, that being said, too, I also understand Russ Diabo's perspective in that, well, this is the government of Canada, and every single time we've ever trusted the government of Canada, nothing positive has ever happened. So I get that perspective.
And let's see if we go to the Declaration Act in BC.
Yeah.
So we covered the Declaration Act in BC being passed, and it was passed in, I want to say, December of 2019, and then in January of 2020, we saw the escalation of tactics amongst the RCMP in BC against the traditional rights of the Wet'suwet'en people. So BC's passing the Declaration Act. And it did come right on the heels of it. So BC passes the Declaration Act.
I want to say it happened right while it was happening,
They're pretty much happening at the same time. Yeah. So I think that's the crux of Russ Diabo's point. But I also think that we are now seconds away from talking to Helen Knott. We're going to take a short break. We're going to catch up on the news. And then Helen Knott is going to join us. Text us at 61010 if you have any questions for her. We'll be right back.
Is One Dish, One Mic, a podcast, now a broadcast, with Carl Dockstader and Sean Vanderkliss on News Talk 610 CKTV.
Helen Knott is the 2019 RBC Taylor Award-winning prize-writing author of In My Own Moccasin. She is has spoken to the United Nations, has advocated for several causes, and is a generally well-accomplished, successful individual who has very graciously agreed to join Sean and I on One Dish, One Mic. Thank you for coming to our show today.
Hey, thank you for having me today.
We have been meaning to ask you to be on One Dish, One Mic forever. In My Own Moccasins is one of the books that members of our community have just, like, particularly the women that lead our community, have said, have Helen Knott on. You must talk about this book. This is truly a book that I think it should be mandatory reading for everybody. And I'm so grateful that you're joining us.
I'm delighted to hear that, and I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we first came across your book last year. We did, what did we do, Carl? I think it was a year in review of authors, and you made it to the top. So this is, again, a year in the making. We're super excited to have you on. One of the questions that I get all of the time is there a family connection with the last name Knott? My mom messaged me, and she's like, Sean, is she related to us? So like, how does Knott make sense out in the BC? Because Knott is a name that we go by down here in the East Coast.
I know I got a few messages from people out east too, asking if we were related.
Are we cousins?
Yeah. I'm not even, no pun intended, really sure. I know that through my father's family, everybody immigrated from like the Midwest at some point too. So I know that it has roots there.
Okay, so mom to be determined. We don't know yet. We'll have to bring her on next year to settle this debate. My mom texts me live on.
We're cousins yet.
Yeah, we'll dive a little deeper next time we have you on a show. But your book was very well received, and your book, for the people who don't know, is. It's very personal. It's very eye-opening. It talks about your life experience in living in, I guess, a colonized world and under colonized circumstances, and some of the decisions that you made as a young individual. So what was that process like for you, writing that book?
It was really intense writing that book. I think the first draft was really angry and very emotionally charged, and it was almost this refining process of going back and sitting with things and letting it move through me and reducing it to what it was. So it was very much my own healing process throughout writing it. And the length that it takes to write a book and the amount of edits you do after, by the end of it, I was like, okay, I don't want to see this book for a long time.
This is a horrible idea. Scrap the book.
Yeah, I was like, oh, wow.
It's an important work, though. You've said that it's not really an exploration of colonialism and the indigenous experience. It's you intended it as something different, to be really unique, and it's meant a lot to women. I really want to highlight that point. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So an intention for me writing this book was knowing, because I've had so many conversations with women from different communities across Canada that had experienced sexual violence to some degree. And a lot of them had carried those stories for a long time without talking about them. And there's so much that comes with that, including shame and just hurt in general. And for me, it was writing that so that people could see themselves and find freedom in that. And since publication, you know, I've had women from all over the country of all different ages, all different backgrounds, reach out to me. And some of them were like, you know, I thought I was the only one. I've never told anybody my story. This could be my story. And it's crazy and kind of heartbreaking to know how common it actually is. But especially when, you know, I get reached out to by a woman who is like later on in life, like past her 50s, and for her to say that she thought she was alone. And that's such a long time to go through life feeling like you're alone. So for me, that was, you know, when I was like, okay, purpose realized.
Yeah, it's a sad thing to say, but it's a common experience that has that very rarely gets any sort of attention. And I think that speaks to the importance of your book, is people can relate, and people have the ability to know that they're not alone, right? There's a special sort of magic that happens when you see yourselves, when you hear yourselves, when you read yourself in a story. And again, that's what makes your book so crucial. And for men too, because men, from Indigenous man's perspective, we need to be better. We need to do the things that are required for us to combat misogyny and combat the patriarch. That is our job right now as an Indigenous man. And that's one of the commitments that Carl and I attempt to make on a weekly basis. Now, with your book itself, again, it has to be hard, I would imagine, because we've done a lot of research in preparing for you to come on, and it has to be hard to keep telling the same story. How do you deal with that? Would you say that it's re-traumatizing?
I wouldn't say that it's re-traumatizing. Like, certain aspects, I've made peace with it. I actually love when I can go in depth when I do more like book clubs, and when they're composed of women or other individuals, and being able to have some of those like hard hitting questions about healing and about sobriety, because I am, you know, in social work, so I've been trained to have a lot of these difficult conversations, and I'm used to them, where it's like, oh, no biggie, let's talk about intergenerational trauma and silencing.
Yeah.
And break that open. But there are times where it does get to be a bit much. And when it is at that level, then I know that I need to take a step back and take care of myself and kind of assess what I'm taking on, taking myself to the water, smudging down. And before, you know, my mom was really instrumental in allowing me to be medicine in those spaces, because she was medicine for me. So she was the one that kind of put me back together so I could be whatever I was in the world.
So I've read a third of the book. I actually thought, well, I've had copies of it, I've gifted away copies. I thought I'd sit down and like take in a chapter or two yesterday to read it. I ended up like soaking up five chapters. Like I couldn't put it down. Like it is an engrossing story, but it's also so amazing that you've really taken some difficult steps, but you've done it. And you move forward, and you've been willing to tell people this story. Why do you think it's important for people to hear this story that maybe traditionally wouldn't have picked up a book like this?
I think even when stories are different from mine, I always look for books that provide like a portal into myself or into a new insight. And I find that in things that are very buried. So I think within my book, there are pieces that will speak to everyone or cause them to pause and think. And I hope that there's like several different portals. I had a book club meeting last night, and it was with a multicultural group based out of Vancouver. And almost all of the women were immigrants from countries within the Middle East. And it was kind of cool because it was ran differently. And they told me what stuck out for them the most. And there were things in there that I didn't think about or themes that they pulled out. And they're like, oh, okay. There was a line here that said never give up, and you read it on a thing, and it made me think this, or this is what stuck out to me. So I never even really know, and usually that comes down to the reader.
There, you've been acknowledged by Eden Robinson. You've been acknowledged by many great authors, but actually Richard Wagamese lived in St. Catharines. We found out, and when he lived in St. Catharines with his foster family, one of the areas where he could truly feel that he could be himself and have a little bit of relief from the pressures of life was reading in the St. Catharines library. So when did you learn that literature and writing and reading could be a tool that you could use towards your healing?
Yeah, first off, I love Richard. He definitely helped me with the beginning of this book and helped me even see myself as a writer. And like it was something that I could delve into. And for reading, that's been a home for me since I could read. I don't remember, my dad tells a story and he's like, you came home from kindergarten and you were so upset. And I was like, why? Said, because you're like, I didn't learn how to read today. They didn't teach me anything. And I couldn't wait to kind of enter into that world of reading. And ever since then, it's been like my solace, my companion, my escape, and my way of like growing personally.
We're so fortunate that you've entered into the broader realm of writers. And this is, I'm going to like say that I actually go to chapters and I try to take your book from the Indigenous section and I sneak it in with the more prominent sections. I think that, do you think there's a reason though that maybe your book didn't get some of the fanfare that other books get?
No, I'm not sure. Like, I know that, I am with the University of Regina Press, so it is a smaller publisher. And I didn't start off in like Kohl's or Indigo, and that's something that my book kind of worked its way into to be available on all those different platforms. And I think coming from a small publisher, it's done really well. It's done better than I, you know, had anticipated or could hope for. So I'm pretty happy with where it's at. But I also know that it's, you know, it is a hard story to digest, but hard stories need to be told and to be witnessed as well. And yeah.
Well, thanks to the good work of Carl Doxater, we are bringing you up to all of the front shelves at all of our local bookstores. So if you see a giant spike in sales, you can thank Carl. I mean, he also may be banned at Chapters, but we'll figure that out. We are going to take a quick break to listen to the lovely people who sponsor this radio station and this program. And we'll be back with more Hell and Not.
More with Sean and Carl on One Dish, One Mic from News Talk 610, CKTV.
You're listening to One Dish, One Mic live on News Talk 610 CKTV, the voice of Niagara. And we're being joined right now live on air, the one and only Helen Knott, who is an author and a poet and a grassroots activist. And that's one of the areas that I would like to explore a little further with you, Ms. Knott, is the grassroots activism. What I can see on your Wikipedia page is it was 2014 that got you going. As you can tell, yeah, we're well researched here.
Point.
Sorry?
Oh, what was your question?
So there was a dam that was to be built in British Columbia, the Site C Dam. And my understanding is that there was little to no consultation with Indigenous people. Farmers were opposed to the dam because of the flooding of lands. And it was just sort of seen as this project that was going to happen in the middle of nowhere and affect no one. That's not a viewpoint that you agreed with, though. You intervened in the construction of the Site C Dam. Can you tell us a little bit about that time?
Yeah, so... I was actually living down south at the time, but I had participated in different events that were going against the dam. That was the third time, or is the third time, that they tried to put through the dam, and this time that they were successful. And there's already two previous dams on the Peace River. And, you know, the river has methylmercury levels that are so high, or still from the two previous dams, that you can only eat one fish per month out of there. And it's flooding over 80 kilometers of like fertile valley land. And in my healing journey, when I was healing from addictions, but also trauma, I spent a lot of time by the water. And there was a specific confluence that I would go to with the Halfway River, the Peace River. And I would just sit there and, you know, cry and pray and smudge and ask the water to show me how to be like it. And I spent a lot of time in that space, and I like made this promise to the water that when it came to it, I would come back, if it came to it, come back and like also try to help protect it, because for me that was that like keeping up my part of the relationship for something that had given to me. And when the provincial approval came through in 2014, that's when I was like, okay, it's time to come home. So I packed up my son and we moved back up north, and we ended up doing a lot of different things, but the main one was a land-based camp where we halted work for some time, and it was skidoo in, skidoo out, and this was in like minus 20 weather. And eventually that camp was dismantled, and even going through that whole process of like being in this like that alternate world, right, where you're face to face with like security and other people and people recording you all the time, and how weird that is, and it's like this like alternate dystopian reality. And the process of healing after things like that, especially, you know, when they don't have the desired result, and it's traumatic. And it took me a few months to realize that. And I was doing an interview in a coffee shop, and I was talking about some of my symptoms. I didn't know they were symptoms, but I was like, yeah, I can't focus. Nothing seems right or interesting. And I'm having a hard time sleeping and this and that. And then I was like, oh my gosh, like, that's trauma. This is PTSD. And looking at that cycle of like trauma and re-traumatization when it comes to colonial practices and the continued like colonial like possession, forcible possession of land and water, and what that looks like. And then where do you go to heal those wounds? It's usually back to, you know, the land. So it was a really interesting process, really trying. And there was a lot of things that we did beyond that too. We did a caravan, so we went across the country to the federal appeal, and as it stands, you know, the dam is still being built, and so you drive through the valley and then you see like swaths of land like clear cut and things being rearranged and moved. And I don't talk about it super often because it's still, you know, it's that active grief and that active mourning that lives within my body as well. So it's something that you witness and process as it's happening.
How does it affect other causes that you're advocating and working on to see things unfold the way that they are? Does it harden your resolve, or ultimately does the trauma kind of win out in a situation like that?
I think after that, I took some time, and it was like, you know, feeling like, okay, well, what's the point? That feeling. Yeah. And then I read this book. I think it was called, I might make this up, but I think it was called The Playbook for Revolution, maybe. But it was a guy who had helped initiate the movement Occupy. But within it, he was talking about how change is long-term, and we often want results like now, here, today, based off this march, which is, you know, understandable because you're there for a reason, but how sometimes small movements create openings for movements beyond that. And so I started to look at change as something that is generational, that I'm like, okay, well, this probably fed a purpose, and I don't know what that is. But in terms of like people witnessing and people being a part of, and I don't know what the impact down the road is going to be. And so being really intentional and knowing that even if I don't see the results today, that there's a reason. And it's almost like how I approach healing, where if you're healing within your own life, that is going to impact, you know, your children and your aunties and uncles and your, you know, future grandkids or whatever. But learning to look at change from that perspective.
I mean, I hope an element of it is having your son seeing you fighting and knowing that I know I when first wanted you to come on the show, looked at some of your spoken word poetry, and I was aware of how things had worked out. But it's still like, again, it's just the beautiful art that you were able to create and the powerful way that you use words. It's impacted and inspired people. Have you seen movement? I mean, this is going back to 2014, but now we're here in 2020. Do you think that we as a people have moved as an Indigenous collective? Do you think that non-Indigenous allies have shifted at all? Do you think that that conversation is taking shape in different ways at all?
So I'm just trying to understand. So you're talking between Indigenous and non-Indigenous allies?
Even in terms of the how Indigenous rights are seen, sometimes, unfortunately, when we look at what's happening out in Wet'suwet'en, right, like there still is an intention to build the Coastal Gas Link pipeline, but conversations have been sparked that weren't sparked before. Do you think that those types of things are affecting positive change in our communities?
I think they are affecting positive change, and I think they're also highlighting conversations that need to be had too. When you look at, I guess, like the divide and conquer that happens when projects arise within communities, within families as well, and they spark those conversations that need to be had. I think the public sphere has shifted a little bit, but it's really interesting, like when you're watching when things are going to kind of go like toe-to-toe, or they're going to be disagreeable to like a public space. When you're watching the media and how the media like prepares people to take a side that is usually like a colonial side, because it happens in headlines all the time, and it happens months before something actually goes down. So you're watching, you're like, okay, they're painting this narrative. So being like really critical of the news that you digest and how you digest it. I know that based off the experience here, so through that work, that was the first time that I really came into like friendship with non-Indigenous people within the territory, because that wasn't something that was a regular occurrence, you know, since I was a little girl or since I was about 12. And now having family or friends that feel like family to some degree that live within the valley, or farmers and ranchers, and, you know, having that sense of like deep compassion and connection with them.
And that's one of the things that we've witnessed down here in Niagara, is we've seen a real shift in how people are having these conversations about issues that are affecting Indigenous people. A prime example would be like 1492 Lambeck Lane. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the story, but it happened in our relatively close to our area. But the narrative that's being portrayed in the media right now is more Indigenous conscious, I would say. I would credit that to people like you and to the stories that you have told and the poems that you've written and things of that nature. Now, with that being said, are we hearing rumors of a book number two to come out that is going to continue that fight?
Yeah, it's funny because I was just thinking about that when you were talking. I was like, oh, that reminds me of like what I've been working on. So I'm writing a second book, and it's called Becoming a Matriarch. And, in this past like year and a half, I lost both my mom and my Sue, my grandma. And it's learning how to step into the space that they left behind, but crafting it differently. And in the first half, like also going through that grief process and what that's like, and then preparing to step into this role. And what I've been looking at in regards to matriarchy, because I come from like, they're just strong women. I don't know how else to explain them, but saying that they were like fierce with heart. Or and one of the things that I found out is, so the Godfather, Don Corleone, you know, Marlon Brando, the role that he played, the original writer of The Godfather, Mario Puzo, fashioned him after his mom. He's like, every time The Godfather opened his mouth, I imagine my mom, because she was loving and ruthless. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. But also looking at the different ways that matriarchy manifests, because sometimes it's not just through our families, right? It's not just the way that we hold together our children or the external members of our family beyond that. But sometimes it's through the work that you do. And it can be that space of like writing or poetry and creating environments that are not so tangible sometimes for people to see themselves and to grow and to utilize. So when I think of that, I also think of like, okay, Kim Anderson, who is an amazing Indigenous academic who wrote a recognition, or who wrote, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just forgot her book. But that book was foundational in my journey. And I'm like, that's, you know, an aspect of matriarchy is creating space for people to grow.
It's such an important topic, and I have a couple more questions. If you're willing to hang out with us for just a few more minutes, I'd really appreciate you carving time out of this Sunday morning to talk to us. We do have to take a message from our sponsors, but you'll stay with us for a minute?
Okay.
Thank you so much, and thank you to everybody listening to One Dish, One Mic. We'll be back in a second.
One Dish, One Mic with Carl and Sean on 610 CKTB.
And we are back on News Talk 610 CKTB, being joined by Helen Knott. One of the things that I wanted to bring you on the show for, Helen, is your take on identity. Identity has been in the news probably around since 2016 with Joseph Boyden, and has resurfaced again with Michelle Latimer and the work with Trixer that she has done. And you had an interesting take. I was wondering if you could shed a little light on your take for our listeners.
Yeah, I was staying a little quiet on this one because I remember the last time that it happened and being vocal then, and it just feels like a continual reoccurring conversation, right? But within this one, I was seeing a lot of like people pointing out the difference between like, okay, well, this is being Indigenous and this is having Indigenous roots, or what that looks like. And I feel like some of the conversations don't take into account, the amount of people that have been disconnected throughout the generations from their communities, whether through the 60 scoop or adoption or by whatever other means, and not taking that into account, I think further alienates people that may be not feeling super secure in their identity and not having answers. And sometimes when these types of things blow up, they kind of stand in the crosshairs. And for me, I also think about my son, because myself, you know, coming from a mixed background, my papa was a white man from Montana, and being in that space where identity was precarious for me, where I was like, okay, you know, sometimes I'm not brown enough, sometimes I'm not white enough. I, you know, was raised in town. What does that look like? And having to come to a space where I'm able to stand in ownership of and knowing that I was raised by, like, strong Dunazel woman. And it's different on my paternal side, but because that is the mind frame that I was given and raised with. And I intentionally raised my son, who, you know, is fair-skinned and he has light eyes. And I tell him, you know, this belongs to you because it's mine and it's me and it's your grandmother's. And this is yours. This knowledge, this being Dunaza, is something that no one can ever take from you or question from you. And he's pretty solid in that. And I would hope, you know, when he grows into a young man and he starts his own family, that he also is able to pass those things on to his children and so on and so forth. And for me, that's knowing that, you know, that's, as a potential one day grandma, that's probably all the grandmothers have ever hoped, you know, for that to carry on, and that knowledge that I'm still here. You're still a part of me and a part of this. And sometimes those lines get interrupted, but it doesn't mean that original intention isn't there.
It's great knowing that our children will get to stand on the shoulders of our success one day and have that pride and sing those songs my story is relatively similar to yours. So it means a lot to knowing that they'll benefit from the work that we've put in. And I'm happy to see that you're making your way with that itself.
There, I mean, identity, I'm glad that you were willing to speak to identity a little bit. I think that maybe there was a bit of identity policing that I know I experienced when I was younger. And I think in a way that our community has traumatized people that have been willing to contribute. And I think we need as many people on board as possible to contribute to our Indigenous value systems, as long as they're not co-opting our indigeneity for their own personal agendas.
Yeah, definitely. The co-opting thing is scary and something to watch out for, because I think that is something that we'll still see, you know, years from now, and this conversation will arise. But understanding how our ideas of identity have been influenced by colonial policy and policing of indigenous identities. And, you know, even when, you know, women were able to come back that had been affected. So Bill C-31 had been affected by the Indian Act, and how that was received in some communities, and how people still kind of held those mindsets almost of like, oh, they're coming back, but they don't belong here, or something like that. And I'm not saying that that's been everywhere, because that isn't the case, but knowing that there have been cases like that, and I think we need to like take that moment to check of where these thoughts are coming from. Like, are they our own, like you said, traditional beliefs, or have they been influenced by, you know, something that has been created to essentially like assimilate us and make us question whether or not we belong or we are who we are?
I mean, Canada and Western ideologies have been relatively successful in that divide and conquer mentality. And again, like you said, it's still plaguing our communities. Are you really Indian? is one of the things that we hear all the time for the people who have been affected by those policies of women losing status should they make the decision to marry out. And that's an unfair burden that we have to carry, right? Our identity oftentimes is not dictated by us, despite us being the most vocal advocates for identity. If that does that make sense, or am I just rambling?
No, it makes sense, because I remember it wasn't until my son was like much older, I think he was like 10, he's 13 now, that I was like, oh, I think I'm going to apply for your Indian status. And I was like, this is the process, this is what it's going to happen, it's going to go to this office over here, and this person's going to, you know, decide whether or not to give you Indian status. And he laughed and he was like, he can't decide whether or not I'm an Indian. I was like, there you go.
That's my boy. I mean, it's such a interesting take, though. Like, I mean, like, both of my children are status within the definition of the Indian Act and as described by the government of Canada and all those lovely people over there. But should I have children with a non-Indigenous woman, that status is gone. Mm-hmm. Right, so both I would essentially have kids, and half of them would be Indian, and the other half would not be. Again, given the government's eyes, and when we talk about shaping identity and who we are, a lot of times that comes into effect. Well, are you a card-carrying Indian? Right, I've been to a powwow where at a powwow they have said to me, you need to have your status card to compete. I'm very fortunate that I have those dark skin and that brown hair and a brown eyes. I look the part and I suit the part, and I didn't have my status card at that time, but that's still problems that exist, right?
Yeah, and it's crazy because it's something that's been normalized here. And when you I remember talking with academics from New Zealand that were Maori, and them being like, yeah, we all think it's really bizarre, like when we learn about the systems that govern Indigenous identity there, they're like, yeah, it's a part of like policy and government policy, and thinking that it's really weird that that exists. And here it seems it's normal, right, where it becomes a part of conversation, or even, you know, having people tell you, like, you need to have a kid with someone whose status, or trying to base those decisions off that.
It's, yeah, we're probably the only people in Canada that has to think of those things. What is your background is going to determine whether or not we could potentially have children, right? Like, I can't imagine any other group in Canada having to have that, at least that thought process in their head.
Yeah, what is your background? But also, like, are we cousins?
Right? Like, are we cousins, Helen?
Age-old question.
I think we've kind of come full circle. We've had people texting in, and a texter from Sudbury says, sending love and gentle thoughts to Helen and your program this morning, Chi Miigwech. Helen, the texter says, we've had lots of other people sending in supportive thoughts. On. I know I'm so grateful that you took some time out of what's, I'm sure, some time when you might be relaxing, and instead of you're having a chat with Sean and Carl. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy that I finally made it on.
Well, we'll see you next week, same time, 11 o'clock. Also, I think we should recognize the fact that you are calling in from BC, and it's not as late in the day there that it is here. So again, we appreciate your desire to come on and your willingness to wake up as early as you did.
Yeah, I don't think it's like really early, but it's Sunday early.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
All right. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for coming on again. And we will have a quick break and listen to our fantastic sponsors where are we, Carl?
Not CBC. 610 CKTV. We'll be back after the message from our sponsors.
One Dish, One Mic with Carl and Sean on 610 CKTB.
You're listening to One Dish, One Mic, and we just had the incredible Helen Knott on the show. And I'm very grateful that she was willing to join us at what was, I guess, not the crack of dawn, but pretty early on BC time.
10 o'clock for us in Ontario time is way too early for me. I mean, I've been doing it for 2 years, but like 10:30, yeah, let's do 10:30.
I've had like professionals approach us and go, why is your show on so early on Sundays? Like, people that, like, I, you know, if a younger person says, why is your show on so early? I understand that some of them like to sleep till noon or later. But I've had like full-on professionals in their 40s and 50s being like, why is your show on so early on a Sunday? I'm like, 10 a.m. on a Sunday is early.
Yes. Sunday. The answer is yes. But also, I'm grateful because that gives me the rest of the day to do all of the lovely things that I need to do, like grocery shopping. That's my goal for today.
For listeners, like, I actually, you know what? I'm a Sunday morning political junkie.
Yeah.
So this, if I weren't on this show, I would be listening to the show, and then I would be listening to the Evan Solomon program that comes on right after us anyway, so I can get all caught up on my political news. For me, Sunday morning is just news talk politics time.
Carl is a 1950s man who goes to bed at 8 3 o'clock every single day, wakes up at 6 o'clock every single day, is ready to go and conquer the world.
It's not. Sunday morning has been a traditional, like the American news shows, yeah, like Meet the Press and all those shows. Like those are all on Sunday mornings. It's just that they became this weird animal after Trump. Like all of American politics morphed into this like thing that went from conversation about complex policy and dynamics to like, I hate the left and I hate the right.
Yeah.
So instead, there's us with our nuanced conversations and great guests like Helen Knott. But 10 a.m. is not too early. That's my point.
All right, that's his point. It's a long-winded way of saying 10 a.m. is just right.
Right. It gives you just enough time to go get a coffee. Go back to bed with your coffee if you want. You know, listen to us in your PJs with your slippers on.
That's fair. That's
the
what
only
I
person
do.
Who has to get up super early is Steve. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, Steve's laughing at us over here saying, guys.
I was going to say, you guys are complaining about 10 o'clock. I've been here since 5:30. You did bring me a coffee, though, so thank you.
Got you, Steve.
Kudos to Steve. We have a texter that says, sing, all caps, 2 exclamation points, three exclamation points. That's abusive exclamation points.
That is.
Please retract the text.
As a journalist, I question your integrity, sir.
A lot of people were weighing in, and someone says talk radio, the last place on earth. Another texter said a great conversation, Will Allen. Oh, that's our buddy, Elaine. Thank you, Elaine. Another texter said, this is a powerful show today. It makes me, a non-Indigenous woman, want to be a part of the change in history. Thanks for being on 610 Radio, and I listen all the time. Cheers from Wendy. Thank you, Wendy.
I appreciate that. That's real nice. What else do we got going on here? The value of this work cannot be tallied. I want to say that was in regards to Romeo Saganosh's work or Russ Diablo's work. It was around that conversation.
Yeah, that's fair. There's still plenty of room to have conversations around the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and what that will mean and what it won't mean. I would like to look at now, as we come up on the 18-month anniversary of the Declaration Act, and now that the BC NDP party has formed a majority government, I would be curious to see. So they passed the Declaration Act. They've acknowledged that the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is this important work. But we just spoke to somebody who lives in a province where Site C is still going to be built. It was approved before the BC NDP Green Coalition government got in. And they more or less said that even if you elect us, we're not going to be able to undo this particular development. And that's sort of the thing, is there's always a reason.
Yeah.
There's always a reason why Indigenous perspectives can't be included.
Yeah. Exactly. That's it. There is always that reason. Moving forward, though, I mean, like, is that the test then? So, like, moving forward, will consultation occur? Do Indigenous people did they ever settle whether or not Indigenous people have the right to veto?
Indigenous people do not have the right to veto. There has to be, quote, meaningful consultation, end quote. So I have to ask you how you feel. If I'm the government, and if you're if you're Indigenous people, I have to meaningfully consult you and go, how do you feel about this, Sean? And if you say, I'm dead set against it, and I say, why are you dead set against it? And you list these reasons, and it's deemed by a third party, or even by the Energy Commission, which is a like a lobby influenced, supposedly third party government. I don't know. They made it cloudy anyways, but no, you don't have the absolute right. Like if you're steadfast opposed to it, the law has now been rewritten in a way that as long as we ask you, you know, pretty please, can we do this? And you say no.
Because that's not part of UNDRIP. UNDRIP was very clear and explicit in vetoing. Indigenous people have the right to veto.
Well, free, prior, and informed consent is the standard that the Conservative Party of Canada is dead set against.
Yeah.
But even that the Liberal Party has looked to soften.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at now. Free, prior, and informed consent has been softened into meaningful consultation. And so, again, I can ask you, and you can strongly disagree, but I don't necessarily have to do anything, if no matter how strongly you disagree, regardless of how valid your reasons are. So, again, there's always a reason why Indigenous people don't have to be listened to.
But what does have to be listened to is us next week on Newstalk 610 CKTB. We will be back potentially with a blockbuster guest. We're still waiting for confirmation. So if you follow us on social media, hopefully we'll confirm between now and then. This has been a fantastic show.
Because of you, the listeners, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Nigitwa.
Love you guys.